This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Noelle Lim. Rituals and group identities are found to be extremely powerful in shaping our behaviour and actions, which can sometimes be destructive. How can groups break out of such action? We speak with Professor Harvey Whitehouse, Chair of Social Anthropology and Director of the Institute of Cognitive and Evolutionary Anthropology at the University of Oxford. He was a speaker at the Khazanah Megatrends Forum in Kuala Lumpur. Thank you for making time for us. Much of your work is on establishing a link between the scale of organisations and rituals and on identity fusion, where there's no boundary between one's personal and social selves. So to begin with, what are the most important factors that drive people's choices in selecting which identity and collective brain to adopt?
Well, it's important to realise that a lot of the groups we belong to are not... We don't belong to them simply because we chose to. Often we're born into groups, or there's a certain inevitability that we'll join those groups in the course of our lives. But the crucial distinction that we make in my research field is between relational groups, so groups based on networks of people you know personally, and what you might call categorical groups, so where we're attached to a group category. Often it's a category that contains so many individuals that there's really no chance of us knowing them individually. So a nation would be a great example. And apart from country, of course, there are religious groups, there are football teams that we support, and the fan base is way too big for us to know them all personally. And we call these categorical group ties. People join groups in order to increase their status. People join groups in order to provide opportunities to meet with new people, to extend their social networks or professional networks. One reason why people join groups, and it can sometimes lead to rather dark and negative outcomes, is because they feel a sense of powerful shared experience with those other group members around an issue where they perceive the group to be under threat. And that can lead to the desire to take action, to take the law into their own hands, and in some cases engage in terrorist acts.
People join groups for survival?
Interesting question, whether it's about survival. We have this construct that we work with called identity fusion, whereby your personal self and your group identity essentially fuse together. So from the perspective of a person who's fused with a group, an attack on that group feels personal, right? So even though you're not personally in danger, even though you're not under attack as an individual, the attack on your group feels that way. So it motivates the same kind of self-defense systems that you might activate if you were personally attacked.
What comes to mind is terrorist or extreme thinking groups. Individuals in the group respond when their communities as a whole are criticized or attacked. How should governments counter these groups or those that indulge in destructive behaviour?
This is a great question. And in many cases, the first sort of instinct of governments and politicians around the world is to say, well, it seems obvious that extreme beliefs are what is causing the problem. So the first thing we need to do is clamp down on those extreme beliefs. I feel this is the wrong way to go about it. I think that of all of those people who hold extreme beliefs, only a tiny proportion will end up actually engaging in violent extremist behavior. So it's that small subsection of that community that we need to worry about. And it's not so much that beliefs are driving the behavior as it is that a sense of intense love of the group combined with a sense that that group is under threat that is driving the behavior. So the question for me starts with, how did they come to love the group so much in the first place? Now, one pathway to loving a group that much that you're prepared to die for it is sharing personally transformative sort of life-shaping experiences with other group members. So it's those life-changing experiences that we need to start with, not the beliefs, not the extremist ideology, but those life experiences. And happily, most people are reasonably comfortable talking about their autobiographical memories, their life experiences. And so, in fact, it's a less controversial place to start when you're talking to extremists. So my view is this is where we begin. It opens the conversation in an appropriate area that actually taps directly into the causes psychologically of the extreme behavior. And if we can get people to reframe those memories, to think about them from a different perspective, maybe even through conversations with other extremists, if handled properly, this seems to me a more plausible pathway to defusing or de-radicalizing extremists.
So people follow leaders. How do we neutralise the impact of destructive leaders?
Well, it's important to identify what kind of leadership is destructive. Some kinds of leadership are worthy and admirable and lead to more peaceful and consensual outcomes. Some kinds of leadership, as you correctly observed, lead to destructive outcomes. So what kinds of leaders produce destructive outcomes? This is like step one, really, in the process of thinking about leadership. I think what is one sort of generalization that one might make about destructive leaders is that they tend to be committed to their own groups above all others, and sometimes to the detriment of other groups. So I call these intra-group leaders, right? And what I mean by that is that they couldn't care less about out-groups. And in fact, if they do care about them, it's mostly they care about eliminating. Extreme examples include Hitler and Bin Laden and such individuals who regard their own groups as pure in some sense and should really dominate the earth, and all the other groups should be destroyed. They're an extreme example, but I think all forms of intra-group leadership are potentially damaging. What we need more of, I think, are barrier-crossing leaders. There are many examples out there that act as models. I think of Nelson Mandela as a shining example of a barrier-crossing leader, but there are many others. And the key thing about those barrier-crossers is that they care about their in-groups, sure, but they also care about taking into account the interests and needs of the out-group, because they recognize that in doing so, you can actually achieve better outcomes for your in-group and for the out-group together.
How do you incentivize more barrier-crossers?
I think one way to incentivize barrier crossers is to encourage recognition of shared experience, not only on the part of your in-group members that you can take for granted almost, but the less obvious shared experiences that we have with out-groups, the groups that we compete with, the groups that we sometimes even regard as our enemies. I realize this isn't easy to do, but it's not impossible. We're all human beings. We all have experiences that shape us. And those experiences, many of them are common to all of humanity, not just to our own in-groups. So step one, I think, in degrading this sense of obsession with the in-group to the detriment of out-groups is to recognize that the groups that we see as ourselves competing with them share our experiences in a fundamental way, not in a superficial way.
In Malaysia, we have multiple ethnic and religious groups, and we are not always cohesive. How could we create more barrier crosses here?
Well, I'm very interested in this question. I think it's a very practical question, and we actually need more evidence on this before we can be too confident about the answers. But it seems to me, just intuitively, that the place to start is not with trying to emphasize shared experience across groups that have particularly strong histories of antagonism. So I wouldn't particularly focus on race relations in Malaysia or focus particularly on what is held in common between Chinese, Indian and Malay communities. I would focus on something even broader still. What do all Malaysians have in common with global citizens, with the world at large? And actually, one very pressing issue that we all face as a planet, as a species on this planet, but we share it with other species too, which is interesting, is the problem of climate change. I think if we put more effort into those sorts of global problems, we would naturally start to erode the sense of differentiation and opposition between our more parochial communities.
This sounds like a way to distract people from the real issues or to focus on something more productive.
Actually, I think it's far more positive than that. I think it's learning a better pattern of thinking, a pattern of thinking that can be generalised, right? So once you've been able already to see yourself as a global citizen and not just as a member of an ethnic group or religion or local community, you already have the experience of belonging to something much, much bigger. If we can start to do that on a global level, I think we can do it in a healthier way on a national level too.
We're speaking with Professor Harvey Whitehouse, Chair of Social Anthropology and Director of the Institute of Cognitive and Evolutionary Anthropology at the University of Oxford. After this, we'll discuss why extreme groups continue to exist even though they are not productive.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Today on The Breakfast Grill is Professor Harvey Whitehouse from the University of Oxford. He was a speaker at Khazanah's Mega Trends Forum in Kuala Lumpur. Extreme groups continue to exist even though they are not productive, perhaps because their members find it socially uncomfortable to exit?
Yeah, well, I think there are good reasons to do with our evolved psychology. The fact that, you know, our ancient ancestors struggled to survive in environments that required membership of a group. If you were excluded from the group, if you were excommunicated or ostracized, that had health consequences in a serious way. It reduced your chances of survival and reproduction. So there are good reasons why we care about being members of groups. But there are certain features of our environment that can make that concern much more intense. For example, if you live in a society where the opportunities for joining other groups, for extending your relational network, meeting new people are limited, then the costs of exclusion from your group go up through the roof. And Malaysia has the lowest relational mobility, or is among the lowest scores on relational mobility measures of any country in the world. Relational mobility refers essentially to your openness to joining other groups. In Malaysia, the kinds of groups that you are raised with, that you go, that you know through your extended kin family networks and through your professional and educational environments, are the people that you will probably spend most of your life interacting with. Your opportunities to extend your social network to much larger groups are relatively limited compared with many other countries. And what that means is that the costs of going against the group, of having a lowered status within the group, are very severe. You can't just leave and join some other group.
Why are Malaysians so uncomfortable to leave their tribes?
Well, this is a great question, right? And there's been a lot of discussion among my colleagues about what causes low relational mobility. It seems to be a particularly prevalent phenomenon in East Asia and Southeast Asia, and this is linked to rice cultivation historically. Heavy reliance on rice paddy means that you have to be a pretty sedentary farming population, which makes the opportunities to expand your social network and meet new people more limited compared with communities that depend on dairying and potatoes and things like that.
Well, 50 years ago, I can understand we were heavy on agriculture, but we're more industrial and services-based now. So why have we not evolved?
I think broadly, and I'm oversimplifying, but I think that there are two quite distinct forces to take into account here. One are the effects of history. One set of effects comes from history and from the sort of long traditions of how you make a living, how you achieve your subsistence and stuff like that. Now, I agree that rice is now only a small part of the Malaysian economy. It's not immediately driving this low relational mobility that I'm talking about. But it's a factor because there's a time lag, right? Our cultures don't change overnight. They often have deep roots and they can have lasting features. But there are also factors that have to do with our immediate environment and or at least our perceived environment. So there are factors that create not so much low relational mobility but higher degrees of conservatism, let's say, or commitment to more dogmatic sorts of ideologies, not all of which have to be local. They could be global in origin. There could be events happening in other parts of the world that feed into that sense of, for instance, being threatened or embattled, that give rise to increased levels of conservatism. And this too can make it harder to leave groups, right? As groups tighten in terms of their norms, they become harder to leave.
I am thinking that for any tribe to survive, they would want to grow as big as possible, have more members, and that should give them the incentive to want to become barrier crossers. But why does this not happen? Why do people not want to cross barriers?
I don't think it's so much necessarily that people don't want to expand their group. In fact, I'm not sure that barrier crossing leaders want us to give up on our in-groups and to join some other group. I think what they want is for us to recognise that the groups we compete with have as much right to be there as we do, and that if we work with them in a peaceful and cooperative fashion, we can all do better, which is a very different proposition, I think. But as to whether there's some kind of inbuilt sort of desire and need to be part of a group, I think the answer is yes. And I think there's evidence of it early emerging in childhood. In fact, I work with developmental psychologists where we study children's desire to be part of groups in a variety of ways. And we know that when children have some kind of concern about the risk of being ostracized or left out, they struggle hard to rejoin whatever group it is by observing the group's rituals much more fastidiously and innovating less. Because rituals are an incredibly powerful way of declaring your membership of the group. I think rituals are appealing for a number of reasons, but one of them has to be that they provide us with a way of belonging. It's not the only reason. There are quite a number of very plausible reasons why we love to participate in rituals. So I don't want to reduce it to one. But if I had to pick one that for me stands out as very salient, it's the desire to belong.
That's because rituals are about signalling our commitment. It's very visual.
It's doing all kinds of things. It's also satisfying the sort of requirements of our evolved psychology in a number of ways. If you took a list of the world's cultural rituals and the main activities that they entail, and then took a list of the main symptoms of obsessive compulsive disorder, you'd find a striking similarity. And that's partly because our psychology was built to pay attention to things like threshold and entrance and symmetry and exactness and doing things in the right order and that sort of thing. So when our culture presents us with opportunities to participate in activities that have all those characteristics, we naturally want to do them. So there are lots of reasons like this that feed into our desire to participate in rituals.
Is that why religions are so appealing? It's the rituals and not the content that appeal?
Rituals are found across all kinds of cultural domains. We think of them perhaps most immediately when we think of religion, but actually rituals abound in every aspect of life, in family life, in corporations that we work in the sports clubs that we join and support, and all of those different domains, right? It's everywhere. Ritual is everywhere. Religion does appeal to us because of the rituals it offers, although let's be fair, rituals, different religions have different levels of emphasis on ritual. Some are quite iconoclastic and try to minimize the amount of ritual in them. But it's also true that religions offer other things that that appeal to us naturally. They offer us ideas about supernatural agency, about the afterlife, about the origins of the natural world, about all kinds of topics that have a very strong intuitive appeal.
Why is afterlife or even karma so appealing?
Well, there are lots of theories about why the afterlife is appealing that have to do with our intuitions that we get for free by virtue simply of being human. Karma is a special case, right? It's not a common idea cross-culturally. I've talked to people in my field locations where I collect data across Pacific Islands, for example, and they find it amazing that such a belief should exist. In fact, they're fascinated by it. But the afterlife concept, all humans have it. Why? One theory has to do with what's called the constraints on our ability to simulate alternatives to what we experience right now. So, for example, it's easy to imagine losing your hearing and your sight simply by covering your ears or your eyes and experiencing the lack of auditory or visual input. So we can imagine that a dead person might lack these sorts of perceptual features. But if you ask somebody to switch off higher level cognitive abilities like memory and belief and stuff like that, it's impossible. You can't switch that off. So it's very hard to imagine that when somebody's body is lifeless and lying there still and unmoving, that those higher level things have disappeared. And it's those higher level things that we call the spirit, that we call the everlasting soul, and that we imagine persists after the human body expires. So this is called mind-body dualism, and it seems to be a feature of the way human minds work everywhere in the world.
It seems like our behaviour is driven by a latent need to survive, and therefore we conform to norms or react instantly to our natural instincts. I wonder what could be the role of education in schools to help us respond more constructively and perhaps to have more self-confidence.
I think education has a very important role to play in children's development and an important contribution to make to the way that society is organised. I think in many countries, in Western countries, that emphasis has shifted increasingly to the idea that education should be all about instrumental learning. And we've seen a reduction in the amount of ritual activity that goes on in certain kinds of schools. It continues in many traditional, often very expensive schools. But in common or garden schools, rituals seem to be declining. And this could spell, if not disaster, at least it could have some deleterious consequences for children. Because we have research showing that participation in collective rituals has an important function in extending and developing self-control and the ability to defer gratification, to wait for an reward later on. And so rituals are important. It's important not to eliminate them from the educational environment.
Perhaps there should be more emphasis on non-cognitive skills such as emotional regulation and empathy. And by doing so, we could create more barrier crosses.
That's a very interesting idea. Recently, I went to a conference in Athens that was dedicated to helping young people explore their ambitions for leadership in the future. A lot of them were very bright. They had to undergo some quite tough tests in order to get to join this cohort. So I was looking at an unusual demographic, I guess, when I was interacting with all of them. But I was really struck by the fact that through these conversations, it became clear that there was a wide aspiration among young people, in this group at least, to engage in barrier-crossing leadership. There was a desire for it. What they lacked were the tools to think in that way. So I think a more structured component of our education system would be very valuable, one that focuses on how to transcend the cultural barriers that have been inherited from our parents' generation. I think a big focus on that would be very useful.
As societies become more fragmented, I wonder how would the study of anthropology change over time? Perhaps anthropologists have to have a more multidisciplinary training?
I think anthropology could be expanded so as to connect far more deeply to a range of other disciplines, not just across the humanities, which social and cultural anthropology does quite naturally and fairly easily, but to the range of sciences out there, particularly the biological sciences, and but in fact all the scientific disciplines, because the framework within which anthropology most naturally falls is an evolutionary one.
Malaysia must be an interesting place for any anthropologist due to our multi-ethnic society with its own eccentricities. If funding was not a problem, what would you study in Malaysia?
I think if money was not an object, I think I would launch a huge survey of football fandom in Malaysia. I think it's clear that there are a lot of fans of football teams that are based in the UK, a long way away. And it's fascinating that people become passionately involved psychologically in events happening on a football field in the north of England, as if it's happening on their sort of neighbouring parkland. And this phenomenon, this vicarious engagement in activities in other parts of the world, is deeply fascinating. It becomes more fascinating and also more consequential as the world globalises. So understanding the psychology behind that, I think, is a high priority, and Malaysia is a wonderful place to study it.
It was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for your time. Professor Harvey Whitehouse from the University of Oxford. I'm Noelle Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.